there, web or podcast listeners. I'm Andrea Lorien, one of the producers on Vermont Edition. And I wanted to let you know that what you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. Short and sweet, right to the good stuff. Thank you.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lafrac. Across the region, reptiles and amphibians are on the move. It's migration and breeding season for many snakes, frogs, salamanders, and more. Today, we are going to learn about some of those species. We're joined for the hour by Jim Andrews, a herpetologist in Salisbury and the coordinator for the Vermont Reptile and Amphibian Atlas. This is our annual herpetology show. And Jim, we're so glad to have you here.
It's great to be here, Michaela. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. And if you, our listeners, have seen any salamanders, turtles, or other scaly creatures that you need help identifying or just want to tell us about, call in at 800-639-2211. You can also email us at vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. And you can even send a photo. We would love that. So, Jim, let's start with the very basics. As a herpetologist, what exactly do you study?
Well, herpetology is the study of reptiles and amphibians, but with the exception of birds, because we recently have figured out that birds really should be categorized as a reptile, but a warm-blooded reptile. And it's really because, of course, that they evolved from the dinosaurs. But we don't claim them. Herpetologists were named before that discovery was finalized. So we are the people who look at frogs, salamanders, snakes, turtles, lizards, and if I was further south, crocodilians, amphispanids, Sicilians.
What are those?
These are critters that really have a body plan that looks like a worm.
Okay.
No arms, no legs. They live underground. And the amphispanids are the reptile group. And that would mean scaly, drier skin. And the Sicilians are the amphibian group. And that would mean moist skin. But these guys are all well south of us, as, of course, are the crocodilians. Though, I got to say, once in a while, we have heard reports of alligators in the state.
Coming from where? Is it all the people flying down to Florida for
released,
the winter that they come up with
released pets.
Something in their suitcase?
Released pets. I mean, they're not an appropriate pet. As you know, I mean, they're going to get too big, and they're feisty little devils. But unusual reptiles, amphibians from the south end up here regularly. Most of them won't survive. They won't survive the first winter. But there is a warehouse in Middlebury that's heated that has a population of lizards that were initially brought up from the south, and they survive. I don't know if they're still alive this year, but they have survived for a few years.
An undisclosed warehouse somewhere in Middlebury.
Yeah. And oftentimes I'll get reports of lizards, and I'll call them up, or I'll get back in touch with whoever reported the lizard. And a question will be, is there an RV in your yard? Did somebody recently bring up a boat from Florida that was all shrink-wrapped? And usually that's the case.
They had a passenger.
These critters came up with a vehicle, and sadly for them, good for us, but sadly for the critters, they're not going to survive here. It's just going to be too cold.
Yeah.
The one species, and maybe I should mention this, the one species that we're concerned about is something called the red-eared slider.
Okay.
Which is a popular turtle pet, and it can survive here. And so,
what's their native habitat or region?
Florida, Georgia, southeast. And the concern is that because they could survive here, And they do get released occasionally. They shouldn't. If people have them as pets, they should keep them as pets. But we get reports of these guys every year. And some of them have tried to nest. And my fear is with global warming, they will successfully be able to nest. And then they'll outcompete some of our native species.
Ah.
Or introduce diseases that are common in the pet trade, but not so common in the wild. So, yeah, we get reports of some weird stuff, us herpetologists.
How often do you get calls about that type of turtle that you just brought up?
Red-eared slider, which is actually a special variety that's pretty, of the pond slider. And we probably get not a lot, maybe 4 or 5 reports a year. Hmm. Of this turtle, and some of those are from the same locations. So turtles that are surviving from year to year.
Yeah,
yeah.
Hmm. Well, if you have one of these critters as a pet, want to tell us about it, or have seen a turtle, snake, salamander out in your yard or on a walk in the woods, describe what you saw. Call us at 800-639-2211. We're on the line with Jim Andrews, a herpetologist from Salisbury and coordinator for the Vermont Reptile and Amphibian Atlas. Jim, this time of year is a particularly exciting time for folks in your field. What's going on out there?
Yeah, well, a particularly exciting time for amphibians.
Yeah.
The amphibians that have spent the winter in kind of upland forested habitat are getting warmed up and drenched, wetted up, so that when they're warm and wet, they can then move downslope into a breeding habitat. It might be a vernal pool, it might be a swamp, it might be somebody's man-made pond. And so they're making that move in order to get to the party, because that's where everybody else is going to be of their species, and go through their courtship rituals. Salamanders have courtship rituals. Frogs pretty much snatch and grab. It's not quite as romantic.
Sounds like college.
And with the salamanders, go through their courtship rituals and then lay their eggs. And so that has become really a very well-known annual migration and kind of a rite of spring now in the Northeast, so that many people really like to get out and see this migration. It's one of the, in the spring, it's one of the first, and people are getting excited about the birds returning, the flowers blossoming, but also the amphibians moving. And in a lot of cases, they're out just trying to help them across the roads, because crossing a busy road can be a very dangerous thing for an amphibian. Most of the reptile movement is going to happen a little bit later as it warms up a little bit more. But right now, it's the early spring amphibians. There's some cool stuff. I mean, it's the sexy megafauna of the salamander world is this big 7 or 8 inch black salamander with yellow spots.
Yep.
Have you ever seen these things?
I have, yes. Yeah.
They're called spotted salamanders.
I think somebody, a listener, sent us a photo of one. Hallie in East Dorset says, I found a spotted salamander in my driveway that wasn't moving and it was very dry. I gave it water, leaves, bugs, and moss. In an hour or so, it was crawling around and I released it. Are they an endangered species, they ask?
No, they're not endangered. They're actually fairly common, and we're fortunate that Vermont still has a lot of natural habitat where we have upland forests and breeding ponds that are close to those forests. And so they're really quite common, but they're given the name mole salamander, M-O-L-E, because like moles, they spend most of their life underground.
Hmm.
And so although they're widespread and fairly common, many people have never seen them unless you get out on warm, wet nights. And those are nights that a lot of people would avoid ordinarily. But that those are the nights when they're moving. And being an amphibian, they have permeable skin, so they would dry out very, very quickly on a sunny day if they were exposed. And so they need it to be wet if they want to make their move.
So if the spotted salamander that our listener Hallie mm-hmm. wrote in about, is that a good thing to do if you see a spotted salamander that looks dry to give it water, leaves, bugs,
yeah,
moss, think, like Hallie did?
Yeah, I think the critical thing that she provided was the moisture. Mm-hmm. The salamander probably was drying out, and we've seen that in our research in the field. If a salamander starts to dry out, it becomes relatively inactive, and you pour a little bit of non-chlorinated water on it, and they perk right up.
And you're trying to keep track of spotted salamanders, right?
Well, we're trying to keep track of all the reptiles and amphibians in the state of Vermont. But that includes spotted salamanders. And I might kind of segue into the information that we have been collecting information, and the we here is the Vermont Reptile Amphibian Atlas. We've been collecting information on these species for 30 years. And some of our records from certain towns are now over 25 years old, and we need to get new photographs and new documentation to see if those species, spotted salamanders, are still in the same towns that they used to be in. And the reason we gather this information is to provide solid scientific information to the Endangered Species Committee and to Fish and Wildlife so that they can come up with appropriate conservation measures for the different species. But I'd like to throw out there that even though these spotted salamanders really are common, we still have, let's see, Berry City, Isle Lamont, North Hero, Searsburg, St. Albans City, Winooski, where these salamanders have never been reported. And some of those make sense. Isle Lamont's an island, so maybe there is indeed no salamanders out on that island. North Hero is an island. Berry City is confined and developed, so okay. Winooski has a park. There ought to be some spotted salamanders in the Winooski Park.
All right, Winooskiites. Winooskiites,
get
out there.
Yeah. Searsburg definitely has to have spotted salamanders.
You too, Searsburg.
Yeah, yeah. St. Albans City, once again, it's limited, it's developed, maybe not, but still, if people got out right now, the thing is to go out and look at the ponds, because most of this migration for the spotted salamander has already taken place. So they've already gone down, laid their eggs, and once the females laid their eggs, they might even have already moved out. Some other spotted salamanders that were just a little bit later getting up in the spring, you know, will continue coming down. But if you just go look at the ponds and look for egg masses, look for these big gelatinous masses of eggs and take a picture and send us a picture, we can figure out what it is, whether it's a wood frog or a spotted salamander. Those are by far the two most likely. Or maybe it's something a little different like a Jefferson salamander, which would be very cool and we'd love to know about it.
Jim, have you ever had chia pudding? That's what those egg masses look like.
That's
to
what
me.
They look like, yeah. To you. No, I don't think I have. My wife might set me straight on
next
that.
Next time you do, that's yeah, what yeah, I yeah. think of.
Okay.
let's take a quick call here. Walter in Ripton is on the line. Walter, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hello, Jim.
Hey, Walter.
I want to mention to you about a predator of salamander and frog egg sacs. There are beavers living behind my house, and on probably a dozen occasions, I've seen the beavers eating the frog and salamander egg sacs. And beavers are considered herbaceous, but I think they're more omnivorous.
Thanks, Walter.
Walter.
Is that true?
Yeah, actually, Walter was the first person to report that behavior. We didn't know about that until Walter reported it to us. Walter happens to live in a house where my wife and I used to live, so I know that place very well in Ripton.
Do you know those beavers?
I don't know if I know the same beavers or whether their great-grandchildren are now there. But, yeah, like I say, he was the first person, Walter was the first person to to report that behavior, that that beaver would be eating egg masses. We would not have assumed that. I mean, like he says, they're herbivores, but you know, it's Jell-O. I mean, that's a nice big container, and you might want to chew on it and see what it tastes like.
Why not?
It's protein. Yeah.
Jim, we got a couple calls coming in, so let's do that first. Jennifer in Royalton, you're on deck.
Hey, Jim. So I wanted to let you know that in February, my sister and I, my brother-in-law, and my son went down to New York City to see Ani DiFranco open Hades Town as Persephone. And one of the days, we went to Central Park to bird, and I was looking at northern shoveler ducks, and my sister Anna, who's the herpetologist in the family, said, oh my gosh, there's a turtle. And it was like, okay, February 9th. So we go over and we look, and it's on the land, and there's a piercing in its neck, and it's like this red jewelry. And every time it would retract, it would, that thing would stick in its eye. So I grabbed it and pulled it out of its neck, and then I took 14 leeches off it and took it home. And it is a red-eared spider, like the one you were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
It is now a pet in my house, and it loves salmon and roast beef that the local stores give me for free because they know I have a turtle living in my bathtub. And it walks around the house and plays with the cat and the dog. But this is a completely rhetorical question. This turtle is obviously native from Florida, but probably was sold at Ben Franklin and somebody chucked it in Central Park. Can I take the turtle to Florida and release it?
Yeah, I think the only concern about that would be the potential of introducing disease. But my, you know, I could get myself in trouble here.
It's all hypothetical, Jim.
But I'd say, yeah. I mean, I remember a box turtle that was shipped back. It was put on a plane and sent to a relative in the South. And then release. So, yeah, I'd say you could do that, and the turtle will probably be fine.
Thanks, Jennifer, for calling in and for the shout-out for Hades Town by Vermont's own Anais Mitchell. Let's go to David in Stowe next. David, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, my family had a red-eared slider. It just passed away this past year, and those lived to, like, 60 years old. Ours was about 59 years old. Just passed away. So pretty amazing stuff. The turtles are amazing. My mom got it as a wedding gift, and it's the same age as my older brother.
Yeah.
So, pretty amazing. If she kept it, she's going to have it for a long time.
What was your turtle's name?
Looter. My brother couldn't say turtle, so they called it Looter.
Looter. Okay.
Well, thanks, David, for calling in.
Well, that the fact that they live so long is kind of a concern because you can imagine you're getting a red-eared slider for a young child, and 10 years later when that child is going off to college, you still have the turtle. And then when the kid comes back from college and then goes off and gets a job, you still have the turtle. And so I think that's kind of the temptation for some people to let those turtles go. But definitely I'm glad that your family kept that turtle. The full 59 years.
Wow, can you believe that?
Until it died of old age, because that's really what has to happen. If an animal is once a pet, a non-native animal is a pet, it should stay a pet, and we should be making the commitment to take care of it for its entire life.
Yeah. Wow. Well, thanks, David, for calling. John in Colchester is up next. John, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to say I saw my first gray tree frog of the year yesterday on a little cherry tree that we have. And it was very exciting because some years we get them and some years we don't have them. But we've been getting them for the past couple of years.
Hmm. Was it gray, John, or was it green?
It was green, but I know it's a gray tree frog. I've seen them before. Yeah. They're my favorite ones, and we're right at Delta Park, which is at the mouth of the Winooski River, so we get
gray tree frogs. Last year we had an incredible amount of the green zebra frogs, I guess it is.
Spring peepers? Maybe leopard frogs.
They're just leopard frogs, guys.
Northern leopard.
Yeah, leopard frogs. They were.
Yep.
Oh, last year you couldn't walk two steps without disturbing half a dozen of them. They were in the grass everywhere. Mowing the lawn was a real chore. But that was very unusual to get quite that many. And our turtle population last year, unfortunately, was very, very low. We normally get map turtles and also the...
painted turtles, maybe?
Painted turtles. Yeah.
Yeah.
We get map turtles, painted turtles, and sometimes some snappers.
Yeah.
But the last year it wasn't too many.
So you've brought up a number of species that I would like to comment on a little bit. That the tree frog, one of the reasons I asked about the color was that when they are very, very young, they're all green. And then as they mature, they can change their colors within a certain range, whites, grays, and greens. They can't come up with reds or blues or any of those interesting colors, but that helps them with their camouflage. But all the little ones are green, and then they get darker. They darken up and into the grays as they get older. But you're right. It's definitely early for the gray tree frogs because they're one of the species that really prefers temperatures, nighttime temperatures in the 60s. But we did that on a couple days. We had a couple days where we were right up there in the 60s. So the species that have really been moving so far are the ones that, you know, as long as it's above freezing at night, they can move, spotted salamanders and the wood frogs. But gray tree frogs and American toads, they like it warmer, and they're still waiting before they make their move. You also brought up map turtles, and we ought to mention that that's strictly a Lake Champlain species that is not found anywhere else in New England, though we have been surprised that we've seen some map turtles in Lake Hortonia and Sunset and Sunrise Lakes. So outside of Lake Champlain, those are the only lakes that we've seen that particular turtle.
Hmm. All right. There you go. Well, thanks, John, for calling in. 800-639-2211 is our number. We got an email from Andrew in Middlebury with a joke for you, Jim.
Okay.
What do you call an amphibian with no arms and no legs floating in the water?
Matt?
Bob.
Bob.
I don't know if I get it.
Well, it's bobbing in the water. There were a series of those jokes that in my decades ago that we used to trade. I can't share all of them online.
You got to do a herpetology joke book.
Yeah.
Andrew also writes, thanks to Jim for all his expertise and entertainment. There you go.
You're welcome.
We also got an email from Jeb who says, we live on a pond in North Montpelier and get a lot of turtles, mostly painted, occasionally snappers, laying eggs on our property. Raccoons and other critters often dig up the nest right away. Is there a good way to protect these eggs?
Yeah, you can. If you wait until the egg laying is done, one thing you can do is cover the area where the nests are with what I call turkey fencing. It's a fence that has openings in it that are like 1 inch by 3 inches. And what that'll do is the holes are big enough so that the turtles can come up through the fencing that's laid down on the ground. But the fencing will keep the raccoons and the skunks and the foxes and everything else that likes eggs. I mean, just like us, wildlife loves eggs, and they're packed with protein. So covering them that way will allow them to emerge in the fall or next spring in the case of painted turtles, but will keep the predators out.
Hmm. Well, speaking of predators to turtles, we have an email about some turtle-on-turtle violence here. Sherry writes, I rescued a painted turtle I saw get hit on the road in July. I was able to rebind the cracked shell, and it did well for 2 years. Wow. I wanted to release it, but couldn't find any water near where I found it, so I took it to a friend's pond. I was dismayed to see other turtles attack it. I took it back as it swam back to me. It had been badly bitten. I released it a few months later in another pond and so hope it survived. What's up with the turtle attacks? Sherry writes.
I'm a little surprised, actually, at the turtle attack. There are certainly large groups of painted turtles living together in single ponds, and I've not really heard about them being territorial. So that is a surprise to me. Maybe they somehow recognized this turtle as someone who wasn't local, wasn't in their particular family group, but I had never heard of that, and I'm surprised to hear about it. But thank you for saving the turtle.
Yeah.
Turtles, by the way, are really rugged, and they can survive injuries that us, we could not. We'd get infections. We'd die. They're just much more capable of surviving serious injury than we are.
So what do you do if you see a turtle like Sherry did on the road that got hit, still alive?
Well, there are people. Fish and Wildlife has a map online of locations of rehabilitators. And some of those rehabilitators will take reptiles and amphibians. Not all of them, because rehabilitators usually have specialties. Maybe they specialize in taking care of birds or mammals. But some of them will take care of reptiles as well. And so if you do find one, you can go online and try to find out where those people are. And there are a few vets which will take reptiles and amphibians. But once again, I would call to see if that's something they can help you with.
Yeah. Well, let's go next to Peter in Montpelier. Peter, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. I maybe 10 years ago, I saw migrating baby tortoises up in Eden, right, on the hill up above Lake Eden.
Sure.
They just, you know, the size of a sand dollar. And the cutest little thing. It was really hard not to take one home.
What time of the year was it?
I'm going to say the spring.
Okay. If it was spring, the chances are they were little painted turtles, because they're kind of unusual in that way. In that, although they'll hatch, okay, mama digs the nest on land and lays the eggs in the spring. And that will start in about a month, mid-May. And then she leaves them there, and they'll hatch in the fall, and that will all depend on the temperature, how warm it is. But they don't come out of the nest. They'll spend the winter underground in the nest, and they don't come out until the following spring. And that's kind of unusual for this far north, for them to spend the winter underground. Our other turtles will emerge in the fall. Snapping turtle little babies will come out in the fall. But because you said you saw these guys in the spring, they probably were painted turtles, and you're right, they're tiny. A friend of mine, excuse this term, referred to them as Oreos with legs because their shells are not calcified, and almost any predator can eat these guys, and so they're very, very at risk when they're on land. And even when they get in the water, they're at risk from fish who could gobble them down until their shells harden up a little bit. But that's why painted turtles live so long, and that's why they lay so many eggs, because, one, so many of their eggs will get dug up and eaten, and, two, so many of the young will get eaten before they mature.
Well, Peter, thanks for calling in and sharing that. An observation from 10 years ago that really stuck with them. Very cool. Let's go to Lynette in Burlington. Lynette, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Two quick things. One is also from maybe 10 years ago when there was really severe flooding in St. Albans Bay. This isn't St. Albans City, but we used to go to Burton Island regularly, and they got badly, badly flooded, and we went to help with the cleanup in the spring and found a spotted salamander there. The young folks who were paid to do the cleanup were a little freaked out about this creature, and so I got to pick it up and move it to a safer spot away from where all the cleanup activity was happening. So that
good,
was
good for you.
St. Albans Bay, but not St. Albans City. Mm-hmm. And then just about last week in Niquette Bay State Park in Colchester, I saw what I assume were garter snakes that were hard to see in the leaf litter, and one was twining around the other. I was wondering if that was mating or courtship behavior or just playing.
I suspect it was actual mating because when garter snakes come out of the den in the spring, they mate right then. And it makes a lot of sense because that's when everybody's together. That's when all the males and females that spent the winter together are still in the same area. Rattlesnakes have kind of a weird way of mating. They will all disperse, leave the dens. And then the males will go later, will go searching for the females after they've all split up, you know. But I think garter snakes have a much more sensible approach. Maybe that's why they're way more common in that they mate just as they emerge. And it's interesting because the females are larger, and the females will release these pheromones, and that will identify them as the female. And then sometimes you'll hear the term mating ball or mating cluster. There may be a number of males that are attracted to the female who's letting off this pheromone, but only one of them will be successful and actually mate with that female. So I bet they were indeed mating. I gotta mention this other thing here because it's really kind of cool.
Yeah.
And that is she-males.
Okay.
There are male garter snakes that release female hormones, pheromones, in order to fake out the other males. So they will attract the other males while they are actually paying attention to the real female.
Oh, interesting. By releasing those hormones.
Yeah. Hmm. So they get the other males to pay attention to them, while they actually pay attention to hopefully a real female. Or maybe they're paying attention to another she-male.
Yeah.
But it's interesting, okay, the variation that takes place. Well, there are all kinds of cool things that take place with mating. Let's say you are a sexy male bullfrog.
Uh-huh.
And sexy male bullfrogs would be the big ones.
I just never know where you're going with these.
Let's say,
go for it.
Let's say a sexy male bullfrog, and they're sexy because of they're big and they have a bassy voice. And it's the bassy voice that makes them attractive. And so if you're a little bullfrog and you don't have that sexy voice, you go sit next to the sexy male bullfrog mm-hmm. that does have the bassy voice.
Okay.
And you try to intercept the females that are coming in to see the sexy male.
Yeah.
So I used to teach junior high for a while, and it kind of reminded me of junior high behavior because then there would be people, essentially they were hanging out with the cool kids.
Yeah.
Because of who they might attract.
Hmm. And pheromones everywhere. There,
pheromones
sure,
everywhere.
Too. Let's go to Tom in Burlington. Tom, what have you seen out there?
Hello, how are you? Thanks for taking my call. And Jen, thanks for what you do. Herpetologists are very cool. I heard your show recently on Vermont Land Trust and went right out that Friday night in the rain and went to a cool vernal pool. And I found what I believe were salamander egg masses, and there were large leeches all over it, which seemed to be feeding on the eggs. And a couple of them had bright orange bellies. And since then, I found a fishing fly called the egg-sucking leech. So I'm wondering whether those leeches were actually feeding on salamander eggs. I'm curious about that.
Yeah, they can. And I don't know exactly what the species are of leech that can and those that cannot. But it sounds like the leech that you saw was a Macrobdellan. the big ones that are really quite pretty, if you can think of a leech as pretty. I mean, some beautiful colors, but really large, usually feed on mammals. But there are definitely leeches out there in the world that can feed on the egg masses and get into the embryos and feed on the embryos, which is interesting that they can do that. It's another one of those things that you might not think of, just like the beavers eating egg masses. But the spotted salamander egg masses, as you may know, have an extra layer of jelly, and it's a pretty firm mass, so they're pretty well protected from predators. Much better protected than the wood frog egg masses, which are, what did you say, Michaela? What are these, the bumpy masses you said it looks like?
Chia pudding.
Chia pudding, okay. You know, they have a bumpy, the exterior of the mass is bumpy, and you can see the outside contours of each individual egg. Those wood frog egg masses are very much exposed. And one of the big predators that people might not think of are the newts that are in those ponds. Eastern newts will burrow right into those egg masses and gobble up the eggs. So, yeah, there's lots of things out there that like those eggs.
Mm.
And,
well, newts,
and leeches are one.
Perfect transition to our next call. Laura in South Woodstock. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi there. Yeah, I just was thinking the same thing. Perfect transition. I wanted to be sure that you guys would talk a little bit about the life cycle of the eastern newt, because my favorite little creature is the little red eft, and most people don't understand what it is or how it migrates between the vernal pools and other areas. And I get questions about it all the time, and I thought maybe I'd learn something from you.
All right. Well, thanks for bringing up the question. Yeah, I mean, if you are hiking on a wet summer day in the area of a beaver pond, you may see hundreds of these little red Fs active on the surface. Interesting, though, keep in mind that as soon as it dries out, these guys all got to hide. They all got to get undercover, or they're going to dry out, so they're all going to hide. And the life cycle that she's referring to is that the adult newts, red Fs, are a terrestrial and juvenile stage of the eastern newt. So they're always eastern newts, but red eft is part of their life cycle. And so the adult newts, which are the green newt, big green ones with yellow bellies, are living in the ponds, and they're going to lay their eggs this summer, like in midsummer. And then late summer, these little, almost purpley brown, tiny little salamanders are going to emerge from the pond. They're going to metamorphose and become terrestrial. And then they're going to gradually turn that beautiful orange color with spots, with beautiful spots, with black margins on them. And those young, those red Fs are going to wander around on land for anywhere up to about 7 years. And they'll gradually mature, and they'll find another pond, and then drop into that pond and once again start laying eggs, and they live the rest of their life cycle in that pond as aquatic adults. So it really is an interesting life cycle, and I think it's interesting that they probably are perfectly co-adapted with Walter's beavers, that beaver ponds would have been the ideal habitat for them. But usually over time, beaver will run out of food in a certain area, and so they'll leave the dam, and they'll go upstream or downstream or over the hill, and then the dam eventually will rot out and break because the beaver are not taking care of it. And so that population of adult newts that was in that beaver pond all get washed downstream. They lost their home. But that's okay, because all the youngsters, all those red Fs, are out there searching for the new beaver dam. They're all traveling around on land, and they'll establish their population in the new beaver pond. And I think this gives me an opportunity to talk a little conservation here, because a colleague of mine in Rhode Island said that what we take for granted here as being very common are really quite unusual down there, that it's hard to find red Fs, and it's hard to find newts. And that's because of the amount of development, the amount of habitat that's been lost down there. And they have protected areas, but the protected areas are surrounded by developed areas, so those red Fs can't get across the developed area to the other pond in the other protected area. They can't move across the landscape. The landscape is no longer permeable to them. And he gave me this quote, which I think all of us here in Vermont really should learn from. He said that at the rate that we are developing land in Rhode Island, we will have developed all non-conserved land in 10 years.
Wow.
If it wasn't conserved at the rate they were building, that they would be building on all of it within 10 years. And this was more than 10 years ago.
Yeah.
So I think that points out the importance of conservation and conserving land and making sure that we locate. I mean, I think the ideal view for our development is to have little pockets of dense development surrounded by natural and permanent landscape, as opposed to having little pockets of protected land that are entirely surrounded by developed land. I mean, if we can reverse that and so that wildlife can successfully move through the landscape, I think we're a lot better off. And to their credit, the state Fish and Wildlife are working on exactly that with the 30 by 30, conserving 30% of our lands by 2030 or 50% of our lands by 2050. Mm. So they're working in that direction to make sure that we maintain working ecosystems and continue to have recreational lands and wildlife lands.
Yeah. Wow. Well, it seems like every conversation in Vermont these days really ties right back to that conversation that so many of us are having around housing and development. Jim, you mentioned the loss of habitat affecting reptiles and amphibians. Mm-hmm. What about the impacts of climate change? What are you seeing?
Well, you know, these animals have coexisted. All of our wildlife have coexisted and co-evolved with certain patterns of weather. And as the climate changes and those weather patterns change, they could provide some real challenges to their existence here. For example, the first amphibian movement that we saw this year was early, like March 6th and 7th. And then, as you know, we had winter come back after that, and we had snow. And then it got warm again, and then we had snow again. So what happens to those amphibians that moved? They thought it was spring, conditions were appropriate, and they moved in March. What would happen to those when we get snow again and it gets really cold? Now, as it turns out, it never got all that cold, so the ground didn't really freeze deeply. And I suspect most of those amphibians this year survived. But what if the temperature, we lost our snow, the insulating layer of snow, and then the temperatures got down below zero for a period of time? Then they would have died. Those amphibians that had already moved would have died. Or what if the weather patterns are such that we get our rain in big bursts, like heavy, heavy rainstorms, and then nothing for a month, and then another burst of rain for a few days, and then nothing? Well, those droughts where we get no rain could be long enough to dry up the vernal pools where these amphibians had laid their eggs. And if that happens, then all those kids are dead, you know. So wildlife have co-evolved with patterns of weather, and as we change those patterns, we're going to see some losers, and we might see some winners, new things that move up from the south.
Those crocodilians.
Yeah.
Jim,
I think it'll be a while before the crocodilians
get it. Here's hoping.
Yeah.
Jim, in the time we have left, the Vermont Reptile and Amphibian Atlas, how can people contribute, be citizen scientists, and help these critters that you study?
Well, we're always looking for people and are encouraging people to take photographs of what they see and send us photographs. And they could send them either to my email address, which is about as out there as any. It's just jandrews@vtherpatlas.org. Or through our website, which is vtherp, H-E-R-P, atlas, A-T-L-A-S.org, and send in their reports that way. And we just want to know what they're seeing, where they're seeing it, and when they're seeing it. And those records are tremendously helpful. Now, there are some records that are particularly useful We don't need to see that garter snake in your front yard every time you see that garter snake in your front yard. Once you've reported it, you can sit back and you don't have to report that one again for a while.
Are you telling me to stop emailing you
there? But we have also on our website, we have a table that you can search. You can plug in a town, and it tells you what we need records of from your town. Or you can plug in a species, and it tells you what towns we need records of those species from. Or any species that's rare. Anytime you see it, we want to hear about it. And we have a list of the rare species as well. So if you find a four-toed salamander, anytime we want to hear about it. If you find a spotted turtle, anytime we want to hear about it. These are unusual species.
Yeah. Jim, last question for you. What is the last critter you saw out there, reptile or amphibian, that you saw it in the wild that just like got you really excited?
Well, I always love to see some of the more unusual snakes. I mean, sadly, right now we haven't seen a racer, big black snake, southeastern Vermont, since 2014 in Vermont. And we're getting together a survey that will take place this summer to try to relocate them. But big, black, sexy snake, you know, 5 or 6 feet long, smooth scales, quick, really interesting.
Oh, very exciting. Yep. Well, we just got an email from Kathy in Aetna, New Hampshire, who sent us a photo of a baby snapping turtle. I'll show you after the show, mm-hmm. Jim, making its way from a gravel nest to the pond we live on in the summer. About 600 yards, a long way for such a tiny animal. It was at Spectacle Pond in Enfield, they write, and at least six snappies made their way. Oh,
very cool.
Very cool.
Very cool.
Thank you so much to Kathy for writing in and to everybody who wrote in. We got lots of emails and calls this hour. It's great to hear about all the critters that are moving around our region right now. Jim Andrews, herpetologist and the coordinator for the Vermont Reptile and Amphibian Atlas. It is always a pleasure.
Pleasure to be here, Michaela. Thanks for having me here.